It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Members of the baby boom generation grew up in Western Pennsylvania and came of age in an America with a very distinct identity and a set of values forged by the work ethic of their immigrant parents. It was a culture steeped in sports and music and ethnic food, where a boy learned about life and himself by engaging in a variety of activities outside of his home with his buddies on sandlots, in church, on Boy Scout outings, and during Friday night dances. Author Paul Hrnecki is the author of a new book that captures the feeling of the people and places of his Beaver County hometown. The book is called Rust Belt Boys: Stories of an American Childhood. He's written stories and essays for the BBC and National Public Radio and joins us now in studio. Paul Hrnecki, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
This book captures the essence of a time in America that was like no other, that sadly, in some ways, and maybe for the better in others, we can never return to. As you sat down to write this book, describe how it all came flooding back to you.
Well, my intention was not to be nostalgic or want to return to it. I actually went to Ambridge from my home in New Hampshire to meet a developer from Australia who was interested in taking down 425 acres of dilapidated mills and restoring the brownfields and rebuilding that part of town. And so a guy with a vision like that, I felt like I just had to meet. And I took a meeting with him. And during the meeting, he was a brawny former brick peeler from Perth. And he ordered, instead of coffee, he ordered from the barista steamed milk and honey. And I thought, wow, this guy is looking for milk and honey here. A lot of people have been looking for milk and honey here. And when I walked out of the meeting, I looked to my right, and there was a settlement in Ambridge that had been established in 1824 by a visionary. That behind me was the Logstown, the Indian settlement of Logstown, that George Washington had visited and then envisioned as a place where he wanted to build the first fort for the first American army. And then in 1902, this was the place where J.P. Morgan consolidated the structural steel firms throughout America and called it American Bridge, and the town was called Ambridge. So was I looking at a fourth visionary? And that's what triggered my research and looking at this town as something that was a renewing ethic, a renewable ethic of visions that various people had.
What was the culture or cultures of the Rust Belt, of a Rust Belt city like Ambridge in Beaver County, back during the 50s, 60s, that era, with so many immigrants from very different countries? And your story actually goes back farther than that, but, you know, you're coming of age in the 50s right. and 60s. And in terms of all this diversity of ethnicity and different languages being spoken, was it hard for communities to come together?
Well, they did come together in places like the commercial centers and those kinds of things. It was Balkanized, though. It was a lot of ethnic islands. People of various ethnic backgrounds had their own churches, had their own stores, had their own communities. They often worked together in the mills because they could speak to each other and no one else could.
Yeah, they were speaking their own languages.
Yeah, and they were manipulated as such as voting blocks by the people who were powerful in town. So I'm going to deliver the Poles, P-O-L-E-S. I'm going to deliver the Slavs. I'm going to deliver the Italians. Hmm. And they would court their favor inside the mill as their foreman and outside the mill as their borough councilman. So the place was a pretty tough ward politics situation.
Corrupt.
Well, yes, in many cases.
And you, there's a great story that you mentioned about giving a speech as a high school student, and you end up, it's a speech of dissuasion, and this politician, he's complimenting you, which of course made you feel very good, but he's actually manipulating you because he wants to get you out of the way, and he offers you a job. Just describe this whole story.
Well, I wasn't sure what his stance was on the issue. He certainly wanted to recruit me as a young person who wanted to be involved. And so whether he wanted to influence me one way or another, he didn't work so hard at that.
And
he wanted me on his side. There's no doubt about that.
Right. And it was a union deal, right, that you were...
It was actually a school district building boondoggle.
That's what it was. Right.
Right. And he stepped into the middle of it. I don't think he declared himself either way, but he was very happy to become my patron and send me to the state senate as a page.
And so there was a way that it sort of illustrated how people could be bought to get out of the way of something that some higher power wanted.
It scared me that way, as if I was being put in his pocket. As it turned out, he was a relatively clean, on the up and up sort of public servant. So I didn't get, once I got into the state house, I saw many more shenanigans that were worse than his.
And it probably hasn't changed much since then. You write in this book in describing Ambridge that ironically only war could give my neighbors peace of mind. Describe what you're talking about there.
We built a war machine, whether it was the 5,000 troop transport vehicles for the Pacific landings in World War II, or it was the the armaments and vehicle industries for the Vietnam War or the Korean War. So to be an opponent of the Vietnam War at a time when that war was keeping a lot of the mills going was a risky proposition.
And you say that as wages rose, so did insecurity and pollution. So the very thing that was sustaining the community was actually, at the same time, tearing it apart.
Yeah. Sustainability is a relatively new word and a new concept when it comes to things like this. And my father was wary of it. He was wary of the increasing fortunes that he was making as a steelworker and his fellow steelworkers were making, not that they didn't deserve it, but he felt as though it was making us less competitive. And at some point, this might just blow up.
We're talking with Paul Hertnecki, author of Rust Belt Boy, Stories of an American Childhood. For many adults living in the Rust Belt, it meant long hours spent in a factory or a mine or a refinery. What was it like, though, for children?
For children growing up around that?
Yes, as you did.
It was relatively idyllic. Really, there were a lot of us, baby boomers. We had a lot of friends. We were in close-knit communities and close-knit neighborhoods. We always had playmates. We had a lot of independence. And so we didn't have a lot of money, but we did have a lot of community. And whether that was through the neighborhood or the church or sports, it was an idyllic place to grow up.
And, you know, certainly as you were growing up, you did things. There obviously were no computers back then. Television was just coming in. But was part of it just that kids could find their own ways to have fun? They were left. A kid could go disappear for the whole day, and you didn't have the helicopter parents who were wondering where they were, what they were off to. Your parents were encouraging you to get out and do things like join the Boy Scouts. Was there more of an opportunity for kids to learn about themselves and discover their own identity and the things that they were good at just through hands-on experiences that maybe kids miss out on today?
You said it. Yes, 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 and yes. I mean, and they wanted us not only to get out of the house and play with our friends, but ultimately they wanted us to get out. And I think that might have affected our mobility as a generation. We grew up in households where we were being encouraged to get out on our own. And fortunately, at that time, it was still kind of affordable for someone graduating from college, or not even graduating from college, but going to work to find a place of their own. It might be a small apartment somewhere, and gain independence as an adult.
You played football, at least for a little while, on the junior varsity, but one day you found yourself in a game trying to tackle Tony Dorsett, who, of course, in those days was known as Tony Dorsett. But
right. How
did that happen, and what was that like?
It was disorienting and frightening. I remember the Hopewell Junior High School had this one back, and they just ran around to end all day. And I was a defensive end. And I was at least 15 of his total yards that he gained in his career because he just ran me straight over.
But you said it was interesting to read your account of this because you say, I wanted a piece of him. So you were afraid, and yet something rose up in you that you, at that moment, you wanted to accept the challenge of trying to tackle him. How did that go?
Well, you know, when somebody runs by you all day, you want at least to put a lick on him. And I just wanted to get, if I didn't, I would have allowed myself to be thrown aside by one of the blockers, but I kept putting myself between, putting him in my sights and trying to take him down, but I never succeeded.
Sports, big part of any Western Pennsylvania town's identity, especially in those days. Mm-hmm. One of the interesting characters in your book is a guy that, as a sports fan, I should have heard of, but I had never heard of, Maurice Mo Rubenstein. Tell us who Mo Rubenstein is, and what made him such a big man in town, and why you wrote about him.
Well, he was a skinny little kid who grew up, went to Fifth Avenue High School, and almost flunked out until a coach took interest in him. And he became I think he played track and he played baseball. And he got a scholarship to Geneva College and became a teacher. And soon after that, he came to Ambridge High School and took over the football program. He went, I think, 6-4 in his first year. He went 11-0 in his second year. His team scored 180 points and allowed zero. And he went on to build a football dynasty in Western Pennsylvania. At one time, Bear Bryant was coming to Ambridge to seek his advice. And Paul Brown of the Cleveland Browns, the Buckeyes and the Cleveland Browns, would have him try out plays on Friday nights.
Incredible.
And then report in how they worked so that they could use them or not use them on the professional fields. He also believed in having small, tough, scrappy kids like himself because they had greater desire. And I thought a great fact about him is his former players told me he never raised his voice. When George Corey, who played for him in the 1950s or 40s maybe or 50s, he reported that when George did something, missed a block or did something on the field, he would just come over and Mo would say to him very quietly, Georgie, why do you do this to me?
I love the story, too, about, you know, all these coaches are master recruiters, but I love how he goes to a house of a kid he wants to recruit who's never played football. His parents are Polish. They don't speak English very well, if at all. And Mo Rubenstein goes away for a few months, learns to speak Polish, and then goes back to their house and recruits one of the greatest football players.
Yes, Len Zaffron, who ended up being a great, great football player, pro, played for the Redskins and the Philadelphia Eagles.
As industry collapsed in America, many descendants of Rust Belt immigrants moved out of their hometowns. How big was this mass immigration?
Well, a rough calculation puts it at about 6 million throughout the whole Rust Belt. That, if you consider, I consider the Rust Belt runs from about Allentown, Pennsylvania, to Duluth, Minnesota, and south to St. Louis. And so that's a big industrial swath, but there were about 12 million baby boomers in those towns, and half of them left. After I sort of figured all that out, working with demographers and others, I found out that the Great Migration of blacks to the north equaled the same amount. There were 6 million. The thing is, the Great Migration happened over 50 years. This Berg diaspora, this diaspora throughout the Rust Belt, occurred in 20.
What is the state of Rust Belt cities now?
Well, you're living in one of the most successful ones. People from Detroit ask me, why do you think Detroit is in such tough shape now and Pittsburgh is on its way back? Well, Detroit lingered because they still have the auto industry. Pittsburgh went down hard. So I think that Pittsburgh's a great model for Buffalo, for Cleveland, for Detroit, and the other cities of the Rust Belt to retool. What I'm most concerned about are the towns outside Pittsburgh and outside these cities, and I think there will be a ripple effect, but I'm hopeful that people will come back here, as they have in Pittsburgh, and show the youthful energy that I think you're going to have next on your show.
In fact, we will. We'll talk about that. But in the meantime, we've been talking with Paul Hertnecke, who is the author of Rust Belt Boy: Stories of an American Childhood. Paul, thank you so much for being with us. We appreciate it.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Coming up, a conversation with the people behind this weekend's Link on Penn event in Wilkinsburg. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA.